It's the Wonky Show. OFS has a new chair. We'll get across his grilling in the Commons. The government's amending its own employment rights bill. We'll check out what's going on. And have skills replaced knowledge? It's all coming up.
And finally, the bereaved parents have said, why can't we put more of an emphasis on mental health into the TEF, the Teach and Exit Framework, next time it's run? I think that's a really interesting suggestion that as chair, I'd want to explore the OFS.
Welcome back to The Wonky Show, your weekly way into this week's higher education news, policy and analysis. I'm your host, Jim Dickinson, and here to reflect on the news this week, as usual, three terrific guests. In Bristol, Brooke Sawchurch, she's Chief Executive Officer at Guild HE. Brooke, your highlight of the week, please.
Hi, everyone. Yeah, a highlight of the week have to be but really the highlight is diving into my specialist members. I spent Monday exploring Falmouth University with the lovely Emma Hunt and her team, and then yesterday I was just with the Landex conference talking all things land-based. So a fun week in specialist world.
Fantastic. In Leeds this week, Neil McKenzie is Chief Exec at Leeds Beckett Students Union. Neil, your highlight of the week, please.
I had a brilliant couple of days with a group of SU Chief Executives, came together in York to talk about the issues facing the sector. Great to meet up with some people I hadn't seen for a long time, some people I had seen a lot of, and really getting into some of the things that we're thinking about in the sector. It's just come back with a lot of energy from it. So that's been great this week.
Great stuff. And in Woking this week, David Kernahan is Chief... edit the script off the tube. And in Woking this week, David Kernahan is Deputy Editor at Wonky. DK, your highlight of the week, please.
Hello, Jim. Not so much a highlight per se, but I have an appointment to give blood on Friday, and I just want to remind all of our listeners to make an appointment to give blood because it's a good thing to do.
Great stuff. So yes, we start this week with OFS. Nottingham Trent VC Ed Peck is to be its new chair, and he's been interviewed in the Commons this week, DK.
Yeah, so this was Edward Peck, who is currently the government's nomination for OFS chair. It's not been confirmed yet as at the time of recording. This was the chance for MPs in the Commons Education Committee to basically ask him about stuff. Now, the big interest from the sector on this is it's the first time we've had an actual vice chancellor, somebody with an experience of leading a higher education provider, as a chair or chief exec. And there's been a lot of hope that an appointment like Edward Peck would help OFS to a better understand what's going on in the sector and the kinds of pressures that people are facing out there. Now, as you'd expect, he did keep his cards rather close to his chest. There was no big, huge news lines coming out of it. He's not going to be a radical chair in the same way as, say, Michael Barber was originally. But he did make some interesting noise about burden. He wants to give the OFS the chance to become as lean as possible in what it does. And he had been doing a lot of thinking about institutional finances as well that I'm certain we will get into in conversation.
Great stuff. Let's hear a clip.
I would seek a very urgent briefing with the chief exec of the OFS to understand what we've learned about the financial position of the institutions where we are currently, as I understand through the OFS, putting in consultancy support to get a really good assessment of how they're performing financially, those that are most financially precarious. And I'd want to know the extent to which those universities have done all the things you do as an organisation when you face financial pressures. There are five or six things that routinely you do. To what extent have they been done by those organisations? So to what extent is the financial pressure they're facing particularly acute because they haven't yet got through all the cost reduction measures that would have actually enabled to balance income with expenditure? And that's the first thing. Now, I think a lot of institutions are still on that journey, and they will get to a point where they can balance income and expenditure. However, there may be institutions where the markets change so much and their business model doesn't let them do that, that there may be a requirement for further intervention.
Well, fascinating. Now, an outgoing VC, there will be allegations of producer capture rather than student interest. Surely, Brooke, some of those mysterious five or six things that universities do to balance the books aren't in the student interest.
Well, given that we don't really know what those five or six things are, I would be careful about making any assumptions. I think that generally, certainly those institutions I represent are actively working to, of course, as they have been for years, balancing what they want to do, their own mission, which is, of course, to deliver excellent and high quality teaching with additional, increasingly constrained finances. That's what we're all rehearsing in the sector, isn't it? I think we have some concerns about, and actually I'm encouraged to hear Edward Peck mention that he wants to look at how lean the OFS, or rather to ensure that the OFS can work as lean as possible, because some of the concerns that we've raised around the investment that OFS itself has been making, paying highly expensive consultants to come in and get a better look, and also to be working more strongly on financial sustainability while also pausing some of their legislative duties, suggests that they themselves are not well balanced in terms of resource. Are they working in the leanest way possible? Is this the time to be thinking about expanding their regulatory remit as suggested in their strategy and other consultations ongoing? So of course, you know, we have a raft of questions, all of which we wait to find out more about as this process carries on.
That sounds the kind of thing that student union people talk about, isn't it?
Interesting. Now, he also talked about campus protests. Let's have a listen.
What would you say, and what would the OFS do if you woke up one morning and it transpired that there was a protest on a campus at a university in the UK in which students had said "from the river to the sea" and called for an intifada?
I'd expect that university taking robust action to investigate those accusations, and if they were found to be upheld, to take action in line with their own disciplinary processes.
I love the idea that OFS wakes up in the morning and then takes action about anything, Neil. But I mean, more broadly, there remains a set of expectations, don't there, from sort of MPs that OFS may or may not be able to sort of deliver on, both on content and on process.
Yeah, sure. But I think what you've got there is a sensible answer. And I think what this is part of a piece of in terms of the recommendation for appointment, it feels like a restoration of kind of good governance and normal government. This is a sensible proposal. And that is an answer to someone who understands the sector and understands the role of the regulator to say, I would expect to understand that the university has followed its procedures. I would be checking on that. And if it's upheld, that I would then do something. I would make sure that they'd followed their procedures if upheld. That's what we want to hear from a regulator. We don't want to hear that they're going to jump in over the top of a university process. We want to hear that they will allow universities to exercise their autonomy, but also be trusted to fulfill their duties. And I think it's easy to think about students being restricted in what they can and can't do, but that feels like the right answer from a student union perspective, that we would be engaged in a process like that. Obviously, MPs still have a concern about control, about what's going on, but that's what the regulator should be doing in that set of circumstances.
Yes, this, I mean, in some ways, it's in marked contrast to when his predecessor, James Wharton, gave a couple of interviews to the Sunday Times before he'd even sort of got the job or Sunday Telegraph, I think it was, about free speech and so on. Let's hear him on regulatory burden, shall we?
The House of Lords Industry and Regulators Committee, I think, made some very important points, particularly about regulatory burden, which I think UFS have to take very seriously. And I'd be looking, were to be appointed, to explore the extent to which UFS has really been rigorous in taking the leanest approach it can to the way in which it approaches regulation. And also, has it followed the key principle of the regulator's code, which is to be risk-based?
Now, DK, if you were on Mastermind, your specialist subject would be the Lords Committee's report and then Behan's report. So, thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, this is, again, this is Edward Pett just going along with what has previously been said. He was right, I think, to point in particular to the Behan report, because this is something that is what the structure of the OFS is going to be. Now, interestingly, one of the aspects of the Behan report, which has not been much remarked on, is that he wants to give the chair the ability to appoint the chief exec and other senior staff, rather than currently it being by ministers. Now, this would mean legislative change, which obviously hasn't happened yet, but it is entirely possible that if he finds that the existing executive of the Office for Students are not on board with these plans to streamline what they do, to stop doing certain pet projects that are maybe taking up a disproportionate amount of time. He gives the example of transnational education, which to me is a data problem more than a policy problem, in that we don't really have enough data about transnational education to properly regulate it, although we do have a really good quality assurance agency that does go out and assess the quality of such provision in a particular country and combine it to that country's regulation. I mean, that's the kind of thing that strikes me, that, okay, if this is broadly working, then does the OFS really need to do anything more than have the code of conduct, rubber stamp it, and occasionally check in to make sure everybody's doing what they said they would do? So overall, this appearance with Peck, if I can think of it in the round, as it were, it was was him performing the idea of what he saw a leader, a chair of the Office of Students, needs to be. Handily, he'd written an actual book on leadership as performance, which I had a lot of fun actually reading and commenting on. So if you want all of the theoretical niceties on that, go to the piece on the site. He was performing the idea of a leader as continuity. He's not really looking at any radical changes. He's not really looking, as Barber and certainly Wharton did, to position himself in opposition to the sector. And he's not looking, as perhaps Behan did, to position himself in opposition to what had previously happened. He is kind of dampening expectations of the idea of regulatory capture that you mentioned right at the top by explicitly referring to these parliamentary and governmental reviews, which have said basically, yeah, there is a risk of governance capture, of government capture as opposed to sector capture. Just to remind people of the place that the Office of Student is actually in, it was a really interesting performance, I think, on that level of the way he expects to lead the Office of Students.
Now, obviously, one of the things he's been sort of heading up on behalf of the government, actually, the previous government and this government, is work on mental health, work outside of OFS. Let's have a clip of that.
And finally, the brief parents have said, why can't we put more of an emphasis on mental health into the TEF, the Teach and Exit Framework, next time it's run? I think that's a really interesting suggestion that, as chair, I'd want to explore the OFS.
There we go. There we go, Brooke. Mental health in the TEF. I mean, more broadly, it's because I've read lots of the sector's responses into the OFS strategy. It seems to me there's lots of, kind of conversation about whether OFS should do things, or whether, I don't know, the EHRC or the Student Minds or, the CMA should do things. This is a real pickle for it, isn't it? Well, where does it put enforcement of stuff?
I do welcome his fairly open-minded response. I don't think we should take from that his intention to wedge further things into TEF. I do think there's some concern around, again, going back to the OFS remit. Is it most appropriate for OFS to take up the mantle of everything that comes across its desk? I would suggest not. I would suggest we have a number of good organizations working in the sector, and that if we want OFS to be as lean as possible, it needs to think more cleverly in that space. That's about all I have about that.
Mm. I guess the other thing, Neil, about the overall appointment hearing is, it would be easy to spend quite a bit of time analysing Edward Peck's performance. But actually, one of the things that I'd got my eye on was what it was that MPs on the Education Committee were asking about and talking about. And I don't get much of a sense that they're really plugged into what's really going on in the sector or what's really concerning students, do you?
I think there's a lot going on in the sector. So to say that they're not clustered around a couple of issues, and I think a lot of people have a lot of opinions on the sector, I think where you get in the responses is at least a clarity about the kind of space that we might be moving to. I think when, the mental health clip that we just heard, I think that we think about how our learning and teaching helps to support the well-being of students. That is an interesting idea. I don't think we are going to see regulatory drift. I hope we don't, into a whole new area and whole new sections. That we talk about in the round is this institution helping to make people feel well? That's quite an interesting idea, isn't it? So I think, you've got quite a disparate set of questions, because there's a lot of things going on. There's many things to talk about in the sector at the moment. And I think a lot of people have a lot of opinions about what they think the university is. And I think that the fact that we haven't had like 5 op-eds and a bunch of answers to say, yes, I'm going to do all of that, is probably good news for where the OFS is going.
Slightly leaner on the way in. DK, I guess the other thing that strikes me is, because he did mention, the three magic metrics, the three magic Barber metrics, continuation, completion, and graduate jobs. To some extent, if he's a kind of not quite a continuity candidate, but there's not lots radical happening here, to what extent is pretty much everyone trapped by that original Michael Barber design?
Yeah, that's a really good question, Jim. As we know, it was Michael Barber himself who apparently sat down over a weekend and wrote the entire regulatory framework in one single draft. You think I'm exaggerating?
Like Pete Waterman, when he says he wrote, "I should be so lucky on the toilet," this kind of...
Exactly like that. And the idea of Pete Waterman writing any song whatsoever is utterly ridiculous, as we well know. I just want to put that on the record. We have got, it's not so much the regulatory framework. The Office for Students is constrained quite heavily by the letter of the law of the act that made it happen, the Higher Education and Research Act of 2017. Now, that was, we did talk a while ago on the site about the idea. I mean, higher education bills tend to be skeleton bills because they're really technical and we do all of the important stuff in SIs. HERA was the opposite of that. HERA specifies things in absolutely insane detail. It was a stupidly long act and it has lots of little technical twiddles in that really shouldn't be there. I mean, all the stuff about quality and standards, it's just an absolute mess. So it's quite difficult for the OFS to act in any other way other than it has been. We saw during the passage of the post 16 and skills bill, whatever that was called, that if the OFS wants to do something else, it basically needs more primary legislation to actually modify that to do more powers. So one of the things Peck said right at the start, the first thing he wanted to do when he got into the door, before even he got the briefing from Susan Lapworth on finance, was to get a briefing from somebody about the law, how it's been working, how it's been interpreted, and how it can be interpreted going forward. He's not really got a lot of wiggle room because the regulator was set up so badly in the first place.
I would just add, actually, that that's quite encouraging to hear that he's asking for that sort of analysis or interpretation, because certainly there were some of us who worked at the OFS during the time of its initial setup who were also reading the legislation, and you know, it, some sentiments among some, I'll continue to be vague, that, you know, that there were very conservative interpretations being taken from the legislation and they weren't the only interpretations available. So I do agree that the legislation is so specific that it doesn't give as much wiggle room as one might like, but more than what I would suggest we've been led to believe.
Right, let's see who's been blogging for us this week.
Hello listeners, I'm Sonny Dillon, a senior lecturer in the Education Studies and Theology Department at Bishop Grosseteste University in Lincoln. I wrote a piece for Wonky challenging the received wisdom of neutral impartiality when teaching in the social sciences and humanities within higher education contexts. I followed the edicts of that approach for the majority of my 13 years teaching in higher education, but in recent years have adapted my practice in line with what's called committed impartiality. To present my case, I drew upon the work of Thomas Kelly, a social scientist who produced a helpful quartet of teaching approaches in the 1980s. I hope you find the piece of value in reflecting upon your own teaching practices.
Now, the government announced this week a raft of amendments to its own employment rights bill. What's going on here, Brooke?
It did, indeed. So the government tabled amendments to this bill on Tuesday. Our listeners will know that this is viewed as a landmark bill by government aimed at increasing productivity and, to quote them, creating the right conditions for long-term, sustainable, inclusive, and secure economic growth. The amendments follow weeks of consultation with business groups, trade unions, and wider stakeholders. They covered areas like zero-hour contracts, sick pay, and other employee protections. Trade unions seem largely to have welcomed the amendments, saying that they welcomed what was effectively no watering down of key measures, while businesses seem somewhat too deeply concerned. CBI is quoted as saying that they feel quite frustrated at what feels like a failure of government to reflect their views in those amendments. So that's where we are this week.
Everyone playing their usual roles. Now, Neil, I guess you know, one of the real concerns in the bill when it was published was this stuff about seasonal work and zero or low hours contracts. Just take us through that.
Yeah, so when you think about students and temporary and term time and zero hours and what's genuine zero hours, what we've always been hearing is the move away from zero hours contracts, and that seems a very simple phrase, but it's actually very complicated in its application. So when looking to guarantee minimum hours, it looks like that there will now be some amendment to allow for temporary. We don't see the word student in there, I don't believe. So we may have some concerns about exactly how that comes across, but it looks like there's an acceptance that some roles genuinely are temporary and that there will be exceptions granted for that, which seems sensible. And then, you know, in terms of on-campus work and student unions and things like that, you know, the way that our bar works, we're doing everything that we can to give those students minimum hours at the moment. But in some places, it's it's very difficult to do. And in some places, we've got students asking us to say, actually, I'm quite happy with a traditional 0 hours contract. So, you know, those exploitative, exclusive 0 hours contracts, yes, absolutely. Let's take those out of the picture. Allowing some flexibility for genuine temporary or seasonal work seems sensible. And I think that's the balance that the bill's trying to strike.
DK, this becomes really interesting, doesn't it? Because I can see how, on the one hand, you know, a student's union operating a cafe might employ someone for 12 weeks in term time and then say, well, no, we can't guarantee you any hours over Christmas. But then on the other hand, I can see how, say, a PGR student on a low or 0 hours contract might be doing some teaching for a university for 12 weeks and then would want something in law that means they can still teach next term. You know, there are tensions here, aren't there?
There are huge tensions. And I mean, what the government has been doing all the way through the passage of this bill is to balance the idea of giving workers the right to a livable job, a job that meets their needs and offers them some kind of security, and the needs of employers in order to employ the staff they need to do the things that need to be done. And we've had a belated recognition that some things that need to be done do not have to be done all year. Now, as the government has dug deeper into this, as it's got the representations and the amendments, it has had to learn rather quickly that some jobs are just weird. They're out of the ordinary. If you think of the idea that if you are working in a cafe or a factory, it might have seasonal peaks and troughs. There might be rush orders, overtime. There might be points where it's really busy and it's all hand on deck, but it's always going to be there. On the other hand, you have teaching, and teaching happens at set times of year. We do have a break in the summer, so students can all go home and help with the harvest, apparently. And that means that there is not teaching to be done. Now, the idea that a postgraduate who is teaching would reasonably expect teaching next term, that's the kind of thing that should be in a contract of employment. That is the kind of thing that unions need to be pushing on. And that's the kind of thing you can't really put in legislation, I don't think.
Brooke, obviously one of the big announcements around this zero and low hours contract thing was that people working for kind of temping agency, employment agencies, would be brought into the ambit of the bill, with the, you know, both the end employer and the agency jointly responsible for making sure they get their guaranteed hours and so on. And I guess, you know, my perception of this is that where people use agencies, one of the reasons they're using agencies is so they don't have to do lots of this stuff about guaranteeing hours and employment rights and so on. Am I missing something?
I don't think so. I mean, I think that's probably one of the reason for maybe the most cynical employers, but I think a lot of the use I've seen of agency workers is because you can't find someone within the suitable time frame, or you need them for a shorter period of time. So you have a bit of a gap. Maybe somebody's on maternity leave or you know, and you have finite resources to try to balance. And I know, of course, agency workers are sometimes more expensive. So it's not a sustainable plan. And that's why it does function well for the short-termism that many employers face. I mean, I think this employment rights bill at times feels a bit schizophrenic, if I'm honest. I feel like we want to have our cake and eat it too. You know, we want to have the flexibility to recognize that some people want flexible work, but also give everyone the protections that they'd want with full-time contractual work. I mean, I think in terms of the sector and those who might be, you know, postgraduate teaching, I think, like as DK says, that employment contracts can make a lot of this clear. And so I suppose some of it makes sense, and some of it I wonder, what is the problem we're really trying to solve here? And is it reasonable to solve it through legislation? I'm not sure.
Neil, I guess one of the things that, you know, I've said this a couple of times on the site, actually, is that if you go into the election and you have nothing to say on student finance, and one of your answers to Martin Lewis on student finance is, well, we're going to put the minimum wage up, you're a government that is basically saying we are expecting students to earn while they learn. But it doesn't feel like this is a set of proposals that has had it at any point until this last minute kind of earning and learning in mind, does it? You know, one of the things I often say is there's a number of European countries that have dedicated student employment frameworks with dedicated student employment contracts, but none of that is here, is it?
No, I think that's very fair. And, we know that the majority of our students work. They're working increasingly long hours. I think there's been some fascinating work that you've detailed on the site and at events when you look at the type of jobs that students are doing and the people who are really at the thin end of the wedge that so often are international students who are in jobs a long way away from campus, who, you know, may not have a full understanding of their rights either. And, you know, there are some key protections in there that will help. But no, I don't think students have been specifically thought about. I think, you know, it's come out incredibly clearly in our work. in terms of the listening we've been doing to students, that one of the priorities our students, both home and international, want us to work on is part-time work. And that's both being able to find jobs, but more importantly, finding jobs that balance alongside study and making sure that their rights are protected in those jobs. What is a good part-time job? And maybe that's the next evolution of a bill like this. I think it does start to address the balance of what's been quite a long time of you can't have a successful economy unless it's ultra flexible and this race to the bottom. And I think that's to me what the attempt of the bill is trying to do of you can have a successful economy without racing to the bottom on employment rights. And this starts this moving in that direction.
Yeah, interesting. Now, DK, there's a few bits in there also. They've done a consultation, haven't they, on the things that were in the bill about trade unions and some of the stuff about electronic voting rather than postal voting and all of that kind of stuff. There's a bit of jam tomorrow in there on all of that, isn't there?
It is a bit like that. The consultation was on, just making the way that you ballot for strike action a little bit more modernized. The idea you could do it electronically, that you don't need to have 50% of all of your members stepping in, and just making all of the processes simpler. It is eventually looking like it's going to be good news for unions. This stuff is long overdue. It was never going to happen under the last government, and it's been looking, for those of us who have been following industrial action ballots in the last few years, increasingly creaky. The amount of time we have to wait for decisions, the lack of transparency, the lack of a breakdown, and problems more generally that unions are facing understanding their members. A lot of it does tap back to that, I think. So it's interesting that we get to this today, because we did have this week the announcement that the University and Colleges Union are not going to be balloting for strike action over the 24-25 pay deal. They're going to be saving their power for 2025-26, and they're going to be putting in the idea of job protections and of no compulsory redundancies into the pay claim, which is, I'm not sure whether it fits in a pay claim or not, but they're going to have a go. We also had news this week from Unison, who are also a campus trade union and have been balloting in 75 campuses for industrial action on last year's pay deal. It turned out they only managed to get the required majority in 4 of these campuses, so it's not exactly going to be widespread action. And giving the expense, which hopefully this is another thing the changes to legislation will address eventually, they have lost quite a lot of money to find out that their members are not really up for that kind of level of sustained industrial action in such uncertain times, which you could argue they probably should have known already by asking their members, but we are where we are.
Yeah, now, student health, student employment, all sorts of stuff we'll be talking about at an event in a couple of weeks. Here's some fella to talk about it. Hello, it's Jim from the team here with news of our exciting student experience event in March. UKHE has a great reputation, but as the resource envelope tightens, it's not clear that what's been sold to students as a higher education experience can compensate for high costs, overcrowded facilities, and stressed out academic and support staff. The result? Widespread health and wellbeing issues, stubborn awarding gaps, and the erosion of opportunity as demand for higher education begins to slip. Some say the future lies in a great unbundling, but in truth, reports of the death of the full-time 3-year degree have probably been greatly exaggerated. So with a new government, a renewed commitment to access and student success, and a regional regeneration agenda, there's an opportunity to build a different vision for a full-time student experience that acknowledges that students are citizens too. They're passengers, clients, patients, employees, voters, parents, volunteers, and taxpayers, each with their own distinct needs and future potential. So as our unique student experience event returns for its 7th year, we'll try to climb out of the doldrums over the student experience debate, asking the question, what would it take for the UK to offer the world's best student experience? We'll get beyond trying to discern the student interest and work towards an ambitious, positive vision for students' participation in higher education. We'll also spend some time interrogating some of the wicked problems associated with particular groups of students in HE. Disabled students, PGR students, students who live locally or less locally to their campus, and the students whose work-based learning means that even the word student, let alone the policy surrounding them, can seem alien.
On the day, we'll round up key findings into the student experience from the past year and launch exciting new findings on the student experience beyond the classroom. It's the essential event for anyone working on policy and delivery for students. That's the Secret Life of Students at the Shaw Theatre in London on the 18th of March. We can't wait to see you there. Tickets and more details on wonky.com. Now, finally this week, is higher education policymaking still interested in knowledge, Neil? That's the question we've been asking on the site this week.
So yeah, there's a really interesting long read on the site from earlier this week covering the background and potential for policy development around, you know, this tension or this perceived tension between skills and knowledge. I think the focus for all of it and the reason why it keeps coming up is this attempt to solve this productivity puzzle in the UK economy and, you know, Western economies post-2008. We've been plagued by low productivity and anemic economic growth. Universities are sometimes seen as part of the answer, sometimes part of the problem, or sometimes just not in the debate at all. And I think that what the piece really helpfully explains to us is looking at how the focus and the rhetoric is moving more towards a discussion of a skills framing where knowledge was where everything was in 2016. It's really important while the sector's awaiting the details of what Skills England is going to be and while we eagerly await a white paper before the summer. Where does lifelong learning entitlement fit into this? And will the role of universities be more defined in terms of their response to Labour's missions and particularly that economic growth mission? I think it also plays a big part into the regional agenda. And I think the piece is very good at explaining how there is a potential for that real engagement with a local economic agenda and how a university can respond to either provide the skills that a local economy needs to grow or look at future employment need and help drive a whole different form of the economy. And I think what I take from it is the importance of a concept like foundational knowledge, because when you apply it against a technology that's going to be as disruptive as artificial intelligence, looking at what the core principles are within a subject and providing students with the agility and the ability to adapt in a way in a rapidly evolving workplace, that's a real skill, but has to have a foundational knowledge behind it. Because in a world where AI might take out entire professions, or at least, you know, take out a huge amount of functions of them, you've got to have a foundational level of knowledge to be able to interact and adapt to that. And is that where universities fit? And how do we articulate that through these new bodies and a white paper?
Fascinating stuff. Now, I mean, Brooke, if I paint this in crayons, as I often like to do, I guess, you know, I think of a Tony Blair-led past where we were a knowledge economy. I think there was a white paper called The Knowledge Economy at some point. The knowledge economy, and that's what universities, you know, that's how universities grew and blah, blah, blah. And now, you know, suddenly we're a skills economy. We need to focus on skills, need to focus on the people who don't go to university, and feels like universities aren't in this debate. And then, of course, the other thing that always happens on social media is someone will say, well, you know, you can't artificially divide skills and knowledge, can you?
This is, yeah, I could talk a long time about this topic. I think when I worked for Chris Millward at Hefke and OFS and was the head of skills, I commissioned a piece of work that sounds a lot like what Skills England is trying to commission right now. And so I don't have a lot of faith that it's going to give us the roadmap that hasn't yet been able to be created by previous efforts. Can you separate knowledge and skills? IFATE and DfE have attempted to do it in apprenticeship standards for some time. Knowledge, skills, and behaviors are what underpin Trailblazer apprenticeship standards. Yes and no, if I could pick a waffly answer. You know, what skills do we really need in this economy? I think Neil was quite eloquent just there and said, you know, there are certain skills, but there is certainly a sense that there's a knowledge base, an understanding. You know, one skill that we need is an understanding of where we are in post-capitalist 2025 Western democracies, if I'm quite honest. The type of skill set that is needed is the type of skill set that is often called soft skills and is the type of things that academic learning at higher levels does indeed impart: critical analysis, academic awareness, synthesizing large sets of data and information, whether quantitative or qualitative, the kind of critical thinking skills that are absolutely the human skills that will be necessary to sit alongside and work with those disruptive technologies like artificial intelligence. We also do, I think you made a good point, Jim, need to think about how we're reaching people who don't normally go to university and not in a way that says we're trying to convince them to come into university, but rather to make the mission of universities much more critical and much more seamed within local communities so that they are clear that we are contributory to their broader benefits. I think, you know, what we're seeing politically, certainly in Western democracies, suggests that there's a large portion of our electorate that doesn't see us as relevant, that is persuaded to see scapegoating as the easy answer to difficult problems. And education is part of the solution to that. But how we go about that, I think, is worth debate.
Now, DK, on the site on Friday morning, which is, you know, obviously when, if I've edited it, this is when people will be listening to the podcast. There's a cracking blog out, actually, from a former degree apprentice who basically says, stop saying that being a degree apprentice is an alternative to university. His argument is it's an alternative way into university, and that some of his colleagues who expected not to have to do stuff about knowledge and books and stuff are, you know, their expectations, you know, were kind of faulty, and they're kind of moderately disappointed that they still have to do some university type knowledge stuff. This artificial cleaving by institution and by sector and so on is a problem, isn't it?
Yeah, there's a lot of artificial decisions. There's a lot of artificial divisions in here that don't really help anybody. And you're right, it is a fantastic blog. It'll be in the show notes, I assume. Go and have a look at it. But it does raise the question, what do you expect higher level learning is going to be like? There is going to be an element of knowledge, and there is going to be an element of skills. There is in every possible field of employment. You can't really have skills without knowledge. You can't really have knowledge without skills. Occasionally, different people in the same industry will have a differing balance of these things. You could compare, say, an architect to, say, a skilled bricklayer. We need both of them in order to build stuff, but without that combination of knowledge and skills. And don't think for a second that the bricklayer doesn't have any knowledge. A bricklayer, if you've ever had chance to watch a really good bricklayer, he's got a pile of knowledge. And I mean, don't think the architect hasn't got skills either. He has to have the ability to make sure things conform to various legal and statutory requirements. It's been a semantic shift, I think, which is interesting in the idea, if we think about the language we use being something that defines the reality around us. In terms of the fact we're talking about skills, that kind of gives the impression that we're talking about something that might possibly be cheaper to deliver. Do we need all of this higher level stuff? And I mean, yes, we do. Yes, we do need higher level knowledge and skills in order to have a successful economy. We always have. We increasingly will in the future. The nature of that knowledge, the nature of the skills is going to change. It is likely universities are going to be involved in providing a great deal of this stuff at the top end, because this is really what they do. And there's not another future, really. There's not another way through this productivity gap. If you look at the way productivity is actually defined by economists, the proportion of the workforce that has a higher level qualification is literally a part of the measure of productivity. You can't take that away and say, okay, everybody's going to get skills training at level 3 without massively damaging productivity as it is actually measured. So there's a lot of language in here, but as to how it comes back down to the realities of what employers do, of what workers do, of what universities do, it's a lot harder to nail down. It's a messy and complicated area, and it's probably, as I think that it was put rather nicely earlier, it's always going to be.
Neil, there's obviously this miserable debate in the UK about the kind of future of the workforce, you know, declining birth rate. No one wants to have the honest conversation about immigration, you know, all of that kind of stuff. But I was talking to a student leader the other day, not one of yours, just for absolute clarity, not one of yours, who was saying, right, so, you know, I've come from India. I'm doing my PGT. I'm doing 25 hours a week at work. Don't tell anyone that 5 of them are off book and cash in hand. But when I'm at uni, what I'm doing is I'm watching someone mumble their way through slides on how to do a SWOT analysis. And I was told it would be kind of practical and skillsy and applied. Is there a disconnect, do you think, in some of the stuff that HE delivers between that kind of expectation of, you know, kind of being practical, being able to apply stuff, and then the reality of what's actually delivered?
I think I'm really excited about the potential of using some of the things that we're doing as a student union and some of the links that we're trying to make in how we start to enrich the curriculum with real life examples, with opportunities to engage with the local community and, you know, when we talk about people outside of the university as well, to really see the benefits. So I think there's a huge amount of effort that goes on in universities to make it practical. I think some students really want all practical all the time. Some students like me wanted all theoretical all the time. I think a good university course is a mix. But could we do more in the space of where we might see, you know, institutions in other countries say, look, a proportion of your credits is, you know, based on your attendance and then is a engagement with the local community or, you know, the work we do around community organizing. I'd love a future in which
CSR for local firms, that kind of thing.
Our community organizing program is accredited with 20 credits. Like, why shouldn't it be? It's got a great like intellectual background. It's a really well-formed program. If a student engages in that and puts the hours in and does the attendance, pass or fail in a year, why shouldn't that be accredited? That's part of the mission, and that's very practical, but also has a foundational knowledge underpinning it.
And this is a bit, this is part of it, isn't it, though, Brooke? Because you know, my guess is that actually quite a lot of that sort of soft skills, human skills, the social capital, the lots of the stuff that we say is imbued by higher education actually isn't done in the curriculum. It's done in the student experience, and the student experience is under pressure because government's trying to make it more efficient.
Possibly. I mean, I think it's hard to take the student experience out of the curriculum, if I'm honest. I think, you know, in just the example that we talked about recently with the student leader talking about what it was like to be in the classroom, that is part of the student experience as well. Is being able to conduct a SWOT analysis a skill? Sure. How do you learn how to do that? You learn and then you have knowledge of how to do a SWOT analysis. That's also, it goes back to your point, your question earlier. I'm kind of convinced now knowledge and skills are the exact same thing. And maybe skills are just when you demonstrate the knowledge you have. So I'm leaning more towards DK's suggestion. This is a semantic shift of the same material. But I do absolutely take the point. Yeah, I think, you know, when our institutions across the entire sector are just increasingly under pressure, and some of it rightly imposed pressure, but others, you know, other aspects, certainly financial, not necessarily their own making entirely. It's difficult, but yet that's where we are. You know, that's where we are. And we all need to reckon with the fact that, you know, the students of 2025 and the next 5 years have a certain set of expectations. Of course, we need to deliver what was promised in the words. We don't like that word. It killed HE, as we all know. But what has been committed to in terms of learning outcomes. But, you know, how you navigate that and what it feels like for student experience is a question. Also, one thing I've always talked about is how well are we helping our students to develop the language that they can use to talk about the knowledge they've gained, the skills they've developed. You know, can they leave their degrees and talk about the ways in which they have developed, enhanced themselves? I'm not confident of that. And I think that's often where they fall down in interviews or find themselves struggling to get those good outcomes for which they have been set up, is partly it can be down to watching them struggle to articulate the ways in which they've developed knowledge and skills. And that's not their fault. I don't mean to suggest that. I think we let them down by not helping them understand what it is they've developed, what it is they've gained, and how they can talk about it in a useful way.
So that's about it for this week. Remember to go in deep on anything we've discussed today. You'll find links in the show notes on wonky.com. Don't forget to subscribe. Just search for The Wonky Show wherever you get your podcasts. And if you want to get ahead of everything going on in UKHE, just click subscriptions on the site to find out more. So thanks very much to Brooke, Neil, DK, Michael Salmon, who also makes the show happen. We'll be back next week. Mark will be here. Until then, stay wonky.